shepherd prophets, the book of Amos. Amos is a country boy. Chapter 7, verse 14. He's very pointed as he talks to Amaziah, who was a priest of Bethel, priest of the northern land. When he says in verse 14, Amos says to Amaziah, "I was no prophet, neither was I a prophet's son, but I was a herdsman and a gatherer of sycamore fruit, figs." So he took care of flocks and he picked figs. That was his job. Verse 15, "And the Eternal took me as I followed the flock and said, 'Go prophesy unto the people of Israel.'" So God prepared him through shepherding and not through going to the school of the prophets, through the institutionalized prophets. So Amos is a country boy. The words of Amos, who was among the herdmen of Tekoa, which he saw concerning Israel in the days of Uzziah the king of Judah, and in the days of Jeroboam the son of Joash king of Israel, 2 years before the earthquake. So we can date this about 765 B.C. About 765 B.C. Uzziah of Judah ruled from 785 to 733. Jeroboam II ruled in Israel. His sole rule is 787 to 746. 787 to 746. So somewhere in that time frame, obviously we have it, so we would take it down to 746 as the latest date. He says 2 years before the earthquake. There is speculation that this is probably the one in Zechariah 14, verse 5, at least a historic one. We know that that also speaks of one in the future to happen. But there was an earthquake that accompanied an eclipse of the sun. And let's read a verse in Amos 8. Amos 8, verse 9 says, "It shall come to pass in that day, says the Eternal, that I will cause the sun to go down at noon. I will darken the earth in the clear day." So internal evidence, some feel it would be the earthquake that occurred with an eclipse of the sun. If that's the case, there was one in 763 B.C., according to the calculations and going back, and the astronomers have done all this. I'm not an astronomer. I don't understand any of that stuff. But according to not astrologers, these are true astronomers. These are scientists. They calculate June 15th, 763, that the earthquake would have coincided with the eclipse of the sun. And if that's the case, then we say 765. So that's a ballpark figure. I guess it's pretty specific, it sounds like, but I mean, it's still somewhat speculative unless they'd find some further evidence. Tekoa is in the southern kingdom. It is in the land of Benjamin, 10 miles south of Jerusalem. At that particular point, it was a fortified city on a small plain. So here is a prophet coming from his flocks, a small plain about 12 miles west of the Dead Sea. How many of you have been to Israel? A couple, two, three? Very interesting countryside because it's 12 miles west of the Dead Sea. The Dead Sea is, about a quarter mile below sea level. There is a drop in this 12 miles of 4,000 feet. And they have to chase their goats and sheep in and out through these mountains. I view Amos as a very rugged individualist, a country boy maybe we have few country boys today as America becomes softer and softer here. I presume elsewhere, for many anyway. Food supply in that part of the world would have been very precarious most of the time. So therefore, when he speaks in chapter 4, verses 6, about famine And he talks about drought in verses 7 and 8 of chapter 4. And he talks about plagues in chapter 4, verses 9 through 10 and chapter 7. It's something that he must have experienced. He was used to the difficulties that would take place. And when he then talks about God bringing famine if they didn't repent. And if they didn't repent at that point, he'd bring drought. And if that didn't solve the problem, he'd bring pestilence. It's something that surely he could understand. He saw concerning Israel. Israel is a primary audience. Israel being the northern kingdom, a time of basic affluence in the north. Chapter 2, verses 6 through 16 addresses Israel. There are then sermons to Israel, and then specifically in chapter 7, verse 14 and 15. 7, 14, and 15. Then answered Amos, said, well, I guess I read that already. Go and prophesy to my people Israel, he says in verse 15. Secondarily, he addresses Judah, who was not as disobedient yet as Israel, but in turn they needed to repent so that they wouldn't go through the calamity. Chapter 2, verses 4 through 5, we see a direct address to Judah. And chapter 6, verse 1. 2 verses 4 through 5 and chapter 6, verse 1. The third audience, as we found in Joel, again he addresses all nations, the Gentile nations. Chapter 1, verses 3 through chapter 2, verse 3, he directly addresses those nations directly adjacent to Israel. Directly adjacent. He does not address Egypt, which at this point is in a state of decline. He does not address Assyria. Apparently at this particular time, Assyria was having some difficulties with the nations to their north and to their east, and they were involved with that about the 760s. And therefore, Israel thought, well, things are going to be okay, because after all, the beast, I don't know if they use that term or not, but the beast is so busy with other problems. You wonder if there aren't many that have been around the church, or many that have looked at Europe, Germany more specifically, and all the problems of the past that thought we'd have future problems, that think now, well, there's no problem because they have so many problems to their north and to their east, problems with Russia and Eastern Europe, which of course they had for a long time, which now they're working out. Now they've got agreements between, you know, well, East and West Germany now is one Germany. Eastern Europe and the problems are working out there. My theory, and this is theory and speculation, and let me address it at that, but I think there is biblical support of this because of what we see in the day of the Lord, but that is that the treaties will be signed to make it very easy for Europe to go against the West, because with treaties and with the problems that Russia has of its own, and the problems that Russia is having with China on its borders, and all those difficulties, that then will allow Europe to amalgamate, to get its power, so then it can be worried about the Mideast. And in some ways, the beast does the dirty work and does some of the battling for Russia and these other nations. Then it's after they take Israel, they take the United States, Canada, you know, the Israelite nations, that after a while, then, you know, things are going well for the beast powers. Then it's after that, the day of the Lord comes, that then they hear the rumblings out of the north and the east. Now, these that they made alliances with and have treaties with, now they have to worry about them, because there's no way that Europe would be able to fight battles on all of their borders, because of the, you know, if they're going to go against the south, and then they're also going to have problems with the east. So apparently some things that they work out in advance. So God is concerned here more specifically with these nations directly on the borders of Israel as he addresses these. There is no formalized military that is an organized amalgamation of armies. I would speculate that what we're going to find as a result of the Mideast war right now and the problems with oil and eventually then with the EC, and when they then put their economic powers together in 92, the next step from that is, how do we fight against a Hussein? How do we protect what we have built now in Europe? And I'm talking from the European viewpoint. What we build, now we have this economic power, how do we keep that if all of a sudden the oil's totally cut off, or all of a sudden, you know, someone attacks us? How do we protect that? I talked to a man that had worked towards this building of the EC that was in France and working with it about 2 years ago, and I asked him the question. It was a classroom situation, just asking questions. I asked the question, what is the military? Are there plans at this point for military amalgamation to protect this economic? And he said, no, there's not, because they have, you know, NATO protects them, and it was the you know, things that you hear spoken of, but there are more and more articles now being written by, you know, non-church members, obviously, but by journalists in that area, political scientists, seeing that this is the next step. I mean, they really have to go to that, because once they have the economy built, how do you protect that? Well, they got to protect their borders. And of course, we're adding to that as we pull NATO out and as we have more and more problems. We spend more and more money in the Mideast now with the battles. You know, that's at least what I see working towards that, you know, for whatever that's worth. But I think it really stays very much in line with what Mr. Armstrong saw for so many years. You know, the timing we misunderstood. Exactly which nations are going to be involved, we still don't know. But you can see a part of the world, and you can see the political direction towards that. That answer your question? I mean, as much as... Well, except when you realize that the mid-range interballistic missiles that they have there, we go through and we said we're going to defuse those. Well, we go through and defuse them, we leave all the hardware. We leave all the missiles right there. They're still where they were. We haven't removed those. You know, theoretically, down the line, they're going to have plans for removing all those out, but that's not their worry. We'll just defuse the bombs so they can't be used. But what's to keep them from refusing them and building that? You know, I would say, and this is a point that we've made in the past for those individuals that think it's going to happen overnight, there are some steps that have to take place. But on the other hand, for those other individuals that think it's another generation or two before they can do that, I mean, we're talking about nuclear warheads, and the ability that with the scientists that they have and with the spies and all that goes on, you know, within that circle, that it wouldn't take all that much. Besides which, the United States has talked about helping them build a military, because we feel they need to take care of themselves, because it helps us, because we don't send our men over there. And the more and more we get involved in a land war, the more body bags that are sent back in the present war, the more America is going to want to pull back again from, you know, why should we be fighting these battles on other lands? You know, why should, I mean, I just heard a deal on the radio today. It was in East Texas here somewhere, and they just had a gathering of a few hundred or thousand, and a family was there whose son had been killed, one of the first ones that were killed over in Kuwait. And, you know, the comment was made about, you know, this war that's fought over there. And, you know, he was held up as a patriot, as, you know, as he ought to be. But this is spoken then in the background about this war that's over there. And if we get in this ground war, how much more are we going to want to pull back? It's interesting, if you ever travel to Europe, I really enjoyed reading the International Herald that is over there and the papers, because they have all these articles about the rebuilding and what's taking place, and the growth economically, and what needs to be done. We don't hear that much about it here, because we're very, you know, what's happening between the football teams and the basketball teams in East Texas, I mean, it's much more. And that, you know, that's probably put down. I think we can get a hold of news, but you don't get it as readily, because there are so many factors. I mean, they are much closer to the potential of war there than we can even imagine in America. We can't imagine a war taking place on this soil. All the wars we've been involved with, they're over there. You know, we go over there and fight. So, yeah, I think that the potential is there. But, you know, again, we're looking at this from the prophetic side of it, and undoubtedly that war will take place. How soon it comes about, who knows?
Yeah, I didn't hear that per se, although the Warsaw Pact really involves a lot of East Europe also, so it's, you know, I would suppose it's kind of, in some ways, been dissolved, hasn't it, by, you know, de facto, but has to, or I don't know, whatever de facto means.
I mean, it's been, in practice, it's dissolved because these nations are no longer under the thumb of Russia, and with all this organization now, they're looking elsewhere. So, yeah, those things, anyway, that's your class, that's not my class. Let me get back to minor prophets here, and we won't speculate too much more. But I think, I'm sorry? Yeah. And I think it's important to deal with. I think we should be looking at what's going on. We should be seeing how are things taking place without deciding that now we have to see that it's got to happen exactly this way or whatever. You know, I still stand very strongly that the Bible does give us the insight as to the beast, these powers in general, exactly who they're going to be. You know, we don't know, though we can, I think, pinpoint the part of the world they come from. I don't think we can name all 10 is what I'm saying. You know, the involvement of the East is spoken of in Daniel 11, you know, looking over to Russia and China. The involvement with the king of the South and, you know, all that is taking place. I mean, a lot of this goes back, again, historically, these things have always been an issue, and they're going to continue to be an issue because you do have the aspect of religion involved. Right now, we've got the aspect of religion in Jerusalem. Jerusalem is the center for three major religions: Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. Now, it's the third most holy city for Islam, but still a very holy city for them. So, I mean, you know, the eruption of war based upon religion is a very real possibility. Based upon oil is another real possibility. And based upon crazy men is a third. James? I would say you're probably the latter more than the former, but I believe a combination of both is what you're seeing. I mean, how are they possibly going to move everyone out of the United States? What they want in the United States is its resources. Part of its resources are human, therefore if they can enslave them to get the, you know, be it oil or coal or whatever it is, you know, resources that are here. No, I don't see them taking, when we speak of that, we're not talking about every individual being taken out any more than in Israel in 721. Everyone was taken out. Every Israelite was not taken out. There were some that stayed within the land. At that point, most were taken captive because then they wanted the resources of the people as slaves and they took them over to Assyria. And yet some did stay in the land. Then they moved the Samaritans down into the land and then they repopulated. In the future, I think you're going to find more that they just stay right in that land and they are then slaves. They're captives. They do whatever the ensuing army does. You know, kind of like what happened a little bit more so with the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire came in and for the most part, they left Judah alone. But they were enslaved. They had to pay their tolls and taxes and they couldn't do anything, you know, beyond. Now, I'm not drawing a close correlation between the Roman Empire then and the future. I think the captivity in America is going to be much worse than living in the time of Paul, early in the time of Paul or in the time of Christ, where they had freedom of borders and they could travel around, whatever. We're talking probably a lot more about what happened in 64 with the decree of Nero that Christians were to be put to death, and 66 with the battle, and 70 the fall of Jerusalem, that kind of thing. But that we would be in the land, and some taken as captives, and probably younger ones, women, you know, those things undoubtedly would take place. Okay, going on with Amos. And yes, I know we could spend a lot more time talking about that, and we will as we go through, as there are certain things that are brought out. And again, I want to emphasize there are some broad aspects that I think are very pointedly made, and that we ought to be looking at what's happening now. Some ask the question, is Saddam Hussein the king of the South? Well, at this point, if you've got a king of the North and king of the South, I suppose he's one of the kings of the South, but he is not the king of the South that we see is then going to be the one
that Europe comes in against and that he amalgamates all Arabs. I just cannot see. Now, that's my, again, that's my personal opinion. But I cannot see Hussein getting all of the Arab world on his side. He thought he could, I think, when he went in and eventually could conquer them all. But I can't see Egypt and others. Now, Hussein in Jordan is leaning a lot more towards Iraq, but then he always has. But, you know, eventually we would see from this leading to the Arab world to realizing that they then have to have some power against their own. You know, they have to have some kind of control against any madman coming up. So what kind of treaties and alliances will they then build as a result of this to try to keep another Hussein from coming up? You know, I just think we're one day closer, or whatever that means. But maybe sometimes, you know, the way things go quickly, you know, perhaps years closer. Let's see, finishing up verse 1, did we finish up as much as I want to cover? Yes, it's to all nations, we covered the dating. Amos, the name means burden, or perhaps burden bearer, the one bearing burdens. He brings these proclamations of burdens, and the burdens are those judgments on the nations. The theme is the judgments on the nations. Chapter 1, verse 2, Amos said, the Eternal will roar from Zion. This is that God is roaring the end of Gentile domination, Joel 3, verse 16, which we just read. He will utter his voice from Jerusalem. The habitations of the shepherds shall mourn. The top of Carmel shall wither. Carmel is used time and again in the minor prophets and major prophets for the wonder and the beauty, the prosperity of Israel, because it is that that wooded area, the mountains north of Samaria, southwest of Galilee, right there on the Mediterranean Sea. You go up to where Elijah undoubtedly was. As the tours go up to the top, you can see across to the Mediterranean and feel the breezes coming across to you. So it's the epitome of fertility, of lushness, Isaiah 33, verse 9. So now we see his indictments against the nations. We'll go through these quickly. Thus says the Eternal, for three transgressions of Damascus, for four I will not turn away the punishment thereof. So we have the oracles against the nations, and he starts with Syria. Syria, which has typically been an enemy of Israel. Throughout time, Syria right now holds Israel as its number one enemy. America as its number two. Let me take that back. I think Britain has risen above the United States as the number two enemy of Syria. And then America maybe is third. The reason I say that is you can get into Syria a lot easier with an American passport than British. Very difficult to get into Syria with a British passport. And you can't do it with an Israeli passport. When we're in Syria, we were there for several weeks for two different summers. You cannot breathe the word Israel. One of the men that was working on a dig in Israel, in Syria, not one of our men, but another dig, had a friend who was working on a dig in Israel. This guy lived in Australia. This friend sends a postcard to the digger that was in Syria, sent it to his home in Australia. Goes to his home in Australia. His mom puts it in a letter and sends it to this digger in Israel, and he's kicked out within 48 hours because the government checks all mail, censors all mail as it comes in. And when they saw that it came from Israel, I mean, it wasn't any card saying they were going to bomb Syria or whatever. It just came from Israel. It was postmarked Israel. So he was gone. We don't even mention the word Israel. You can't take literature in about Israel, nothing. So, you know, they are an enemy of Israel and have been as they lobbed shells back in the 70s down from the Golan Heights down to Israel. Finally, Israel took the Golan Heights. How can you blame them when you're living down in the valley and Syria keeps lobbing shells on you and destroying your towns and killing your people? After all, you figure, hey,
I don't care if this has, if that had been their land for X number of years, they aren't using it right, we're going to take it, which they did in quite a battle in order to take it. Because they have threshed Gilead with threshing instruments of iron. So he's talking really about the cruelty of Syria. 2 Kings 13, verse 7, 8, verse 12, 10, verses 32 through 33. That was 2 Kings 13, 7, 8, 12, 10, 32. And he talks about the house of Hazael. We don't know who that is, apparently a Syrian king, which shall devour the palaces of Ben-Hadad. Ben-Hadad is a title of the Syrian kings. It means son of the sun god. So talking about the palaces of the ruler, the son of the sun god. I will break also the bar of Damascus, the gate of Damascus, cut off the inhabitant from the plain of Avon. Remember, Avon means nothingness, as we said in Amos. It holds the scepter from the house of Eden, and the people of Syria shall go into captivity unto Kir, says the Eternal. Kir is in some obscure place, but anyway, they go into captivity. Yes? Well, since this is written after Elisha, that's a question. Who is this Hazael? Is this a later one? Is this maybe a title that goes then from king to king? And we're talking about titles, quite possibly. It then goes after that. I don't know anything further on that. Maybe a good term paper. All these other questions that you ask, I have no answer to. I'll tell you to write a term paper on it. Okay, then we go to Gaza, which is the land of the Philistines, and he mentions four of the five major cities of the Philistines. Gaza, verse 8, Ashdod, Ashkelon, and Ekron. The fifth city is Gath. It was a major city of the Philistines. They delivered the Jews to Edom, he says, because they carried away captive the whole captivity to deliver them up to Edom. And this happened after 587. There were many Edomites in Nebuchadnezzar's army that were very gleeful at the fall of Israel and of Judah. Judah at that point in 587, and then delivered them up to captivity. So God punishes them. Verse 9, we see that he's angry at Tyre. Tyre is the one of the main cities of the Phoenicians. The Phoenicians, who were the sea people who then settled in Tyre and in Sidon. References to the people of Tyre, Isaiah 23, Jeremiah 25, verse 22, Ezekiel 26 through 28. Because they delivered the whole captivity to Edom and remembered not the brotherly covenant. So Tyre helped in delivering Judah to the Edomites. They did not pay heed to the brotherly covenant. And I will send a fire or destruction on the wall of Tyre and devour the palaces thereof. We'll come back to this concept of the brotherly covenant in a couple of minutes. Verse 11, then he talks about the transgressions of Edom. So this is the fourth decree. And because of, he says, I will not turn away the punishment thereof, because he did pursue his brother with the sword, did cast off all pity, and his anger did tear perpetually, and he kept his wrath forever. Remember that Edom is another name for Esau. Esau despised his birthright. In other words, he didn't hold it up for the value that it had. He sold his birthright. No one forced him to sell it. He sold it. Jacob then stole a blessing. And Esau was left with the blessing we find in Genesis 27, verses 38 through 40. Genesis 27, 38 through 40. Now, this is not to say that Jacob had some culpability in the matter, but he holds Esau responsible in that Esau's bitterness led him to the hatred and the anger and the killing that then took place. And, of course, generations later,
You can go to the Hatfields and the McCoys, and you can see that feuds still continue in the hills of Kentucky or whatever, you know, families. Is that where they are now? Among maybe other hills, and generations later, because some feud, and I suppose there are books written trying to figure out where the feud started. But it didn't make any difference where the feud started, because you got McCoy blood in you, and I got Hatfield blood in me, therefore we're going to continue to fight. And this is a basic concept of Esau, the Edomites, as they have continued through time. These people that then finally did migrate, many of them, up to the land of Turkey. Turkey, we know, has been very animus against, has had animosity against Israel. 1517 to 1917, they controlled the land of Israel, and they raped and pillaged the land. They, in part, well,